White Rocket Entertainment.
Hi, this is Lana Wood. I was Plenty O'Toole in Diamonds Are Forever, but nevertheless, you can see this, hear this. You can't see it. Well, maybe you can if you're really special on Her Majesty's Secret Podcast.
Welcome back to a very special episode of On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast. You guys know me, I'm Jared Albrick, aka The Yard Sale Artist, and I am thrilled to have with us today special guest, straight from England, James Bond comic writer Simon Jowett. Welcome to the show, Simon.
Hi, Jared. I'm absolutely as thrilled to be here as you are to have me.
Oh, I don't know if that's possible, but that's cool. As our listeners will know, obviously, this is On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast, so we love James Bond stuff. And on my other show that I do, The Long Box Crusade, with those guys, we love comic books. So Simon's landing perfectly in the middle of that little Venn diagram, which is a comment that I just made up on my own. I'm kidding. Simon mentioned that earlier in our pre-talk. Yes, he's clever enough.
You're kind of getting a two-for-one.
Yes, I really am. I've got a great comic creator and a great Bond writer all in one. So thank you so much for being on our show, Simon. We really appreciate
it. It's an absolute pleasure.
All right. Now, Simon wrote the Dark Horse comics back in the mid-90s. He did a series called A Silent Armageddon, and he did the series called Shattered Helix. I think Armageddon was in 93 and Shattered Helix was in 94, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. That's absolutely right. Shattered Helix was the second project I did for them.
Excellent. That's amazing. And they're good stuff, folks. I've re-boned up on them and read them again this week, prepping for this interview, and highly recommend that you go out and get them. They are available on, eBay or auction sites, things like that. Always support your local comic shop if you can, if they've got it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But they're very good, and I highly recommend them. So let's jump into it and find out what Simon's general thoughts on James Bond are. So are you excited about the quick fire round we have here, Simon?
yeah, I'm ready. I've scribbled notes. I feel like I've been studying for some kind of test, actually. Racking my brains. Oh, God, yes.
Okay. Don't worry.
Hoping they're good answers is all I can say.
Do not worry. In the realm of James Bond, there are no right or wrong answers, but we all will be silently judging you.
Okay. That's good to know.
Okay. Simon, how did you first come to Bond? What's your first memory of Bond? What drew you into the James Bond universe,
memory? Really going into the mists of time, because the first memory I have was being bought an annual. I don't know if that makes any sense to an American listener, just kind of a large hardback thing that comes out at the end of each year and usually attached to some intellectual property. And this was the James Bond annual 1968. And I remember it mostly because it had a strip adaptation of Live and Let Die in it, and I have no idea who did the adaptation, but that memory has kind of stuck with me since then, really. And I remember it making a real impression of just the storytelling and the story itself. And I do remember growing up sort of in the house where the things on my parents' bookshelves were the paperback. I think maybe they were the first paperback editions of the various Bond books. One that really, really, really sort of stuck with me was Live and Let Die. And I remember later on, was it Thunderball? Had a die-cut cover. Oh. It had a fake bullet hole through the front cover.
How cool is that?
And they were published by an imprint called Pan in the UK. I don't know who their parent company was, but it's those two, the cover designs on the paperbacks and especially that strip adaptation of Live and Let Die in the Bond Annual 1968. So we're in Connery era still, I believe. I think we are.
Yeah, correct.
Just about. they're the two, and so I've kind of, it does feel like I've grown up with Bond. Certainly the cinematic version, anyway. But I wasn't. But the idea of writing Bond was never something that was a serious ambition, because that was just something that was kind of glamorous and in the distance, and other people did, and I happily consumed. For me, it was writing was the important thing, the thing that I kind of fixed upon to do. I was around 8 years old when I first decided writing was probably going to be the thing, and then I fell in love with comics, and so the two sort of eventually coincided after the sort of the obligatory education, university, really lousy jobs in restaurants and cleaning this, that, and the other. Although I do still, I have to say, I don't know how many other Bond writers can say, I do still make a very good martini, because one of my jobs was cocktail bartender.
I can
make you a martini should you ever desire.
Excellent. I want to go back and ask you a question about the 1968 annual, which I'm sure I'm going to try to find and collect now, thanks to you. Appreciate that. You basically just gave me a bill to pay.
That's more eBay for you, I think.
Was that annual, because in American comics, we have annuals that come out and they're just kind of thicker comic book issues.
Sure. This is a hardback book. They usually contain sort of lots of things like little fact files, sometimes original stories, prose stories. Bits and pieces. They're kind of a compendium of information about whatever the intellectual property is they're dealing with. It can be James Bond, Doctor Who, you name it. Those things. And this had the adaptation, the Live and Let Die adaptation. Thinking back, I'm guessing it was like someone had collated, cut and pasted a newspaper strip. Because thinking back to the formatting on the page, I get the impression it was possibly a newspaper strip that was then sort of reproduced in the pages of the annual. So no, I do remember it containing sort of all sorts of trivia, things like Bond's family background, his military experience, all that kind of thing. And so it's kind of done as a package for the young fan, really.
Okay, well, I'm going to be tracking that down. So
all right, in that case.
So that's interesting that it was, you know, around 1968, and your first step into the James Bond universe is really that annual when the movies are becoming very big and very popular. It's very interesting that the movies wasn't your first step, but I'm sure that followed probably in short order. And
yeah, I mean, I think, cause I remember the first film, the first Bond film I have a vivid memory of seeing, is from Russia with Love.
Excellent.
And that's the first of the films. So Connery really was my first Bond, in the same way as, I don't know if you're a Doctor Who fan or anything like that, but people always ask, you know, which one is your Doctor?
Oh, right, and right.
It's kind of my first Bond.
I got you. Which, well, that leads me to our next question, which is, who is your favorite Bond actor? Does it begin and end with Connery for you?
No, it all gets much more complicated after that.
Oh, boy, here we go.
No, it should be no surprise to you, I guess, having listened to me witter this long. Connery, obviously, he looms large, absolutely. But at the time I was writing, not Shattered Helix, Silent Armageddon, there hadn't really been a major Bond release for a little while, and Timothy Dalton had done his two. Mm-hmm. So by way of research, I hadn't seen them at the cinema. I rented VHS tapes of both the films and watched them. And I always considered him a really underrated interpretation of Bond. I liked the much more low-key, much more down-to-earth, less gadget-heavy. I mean, in common with a lot of people, I guess I'd sort of been turned off by the camp that crept in during the Roger Moore period. So I have a real fondness for Timothy Dalton. I have a real fondness for Timothy Dalton just as an actor.
Same here.
And then after that, I watched Casino Royale, sort of the first of the new Bond, and with Daniel Craig being like really impressed. The particular level of physicality that he brings to it is just really impressive. And so, I mean, Casino Royale sort of surprised the hell out of me and has become one of my favorite Bond films.
Excellent.
So there you go. Three for the price of one.
But I'm really glad that you brought up Timothy Dalton, because Timothy Dalton's my favorite and I feel he's underrated as well. So it's always nice to hear my opinions validated.
It's one of those things when you get like just someone who is a quality actor can just bring so much to what could be a very cardboard part. But you get someone like Timothy Dalton rocks in with it, and he brings a lot of the unspoken stuff to the role, which is fantastic, I think. And he does have that amazing ability. Is when he's clean shaven, he's a hero. But when he gets the moustache on,
he's a villain.
Yeah, I loved him in Rocketeer.
Yes,
he was an excellent villain in Rocketeer.
Gave a great performance in that. Excellent. So we've talked about your favorite actor. You've mentioned a couple of films that you liked. Do you ultimately have a favorite 007 film?
Ooh, well, if you can call it the classic era, if I can say the classic era, and you know what, and you have a rough idea of what I mean, right. I kind of have to go. I come back to Goldfinger every time.
Nothing wrong with that.
I mean, it's probably really very unadventurous, that one, but it does just seem to. It seems to be the total package by that point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Kind of enjoy some of the period details at the beginning of Dr. No, but that's just the period stuff. But no, as a total Bond package, it's really hard to beat Goldfinger, I think. But then again, that said, I really enjoy both of Timothy Dalton's, and again, Casino Royale, especially the first half of Casino Royale, has got like a real it's a real statement.
It is.
I really like the statement that it makes about Bond. I would say Goldfinger to Casino Royale, with sort of a quick visit to Living Daylights. I keep wanting to call it License Revoked because that was an early
time. Right. But yes, License to Kill, by the way, is definitely one of my top, if not my top films.
Really? My top film
changes depending on which way the wind blows, but License to Kill and Goldfinger are definitely in the running. Those two.
Oh, glad to hear it too. You're a man of rare taste.
I see why we're getting along so well. Oh, so we've talked about Bonds, we've talked about movies. What about villains? Who's your favorite Bond villain? Who really kind of captured you? Like, oh, I kind of like this guy's style, you know, even though he's a bad guy.
Well, I mean, the fact that Erno Goldfinger got to be up there, considering he's part of that film.
Yes.
Of the Blofelds, I really like the Telly Savalas version of Blofeld.
Nice.
In On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Mm-hmm. And sort of moving away from the classic era, I kind of like the idea of Quantum.
Yes.
The idea of it, it's kind of not one villain, but it's a network. The network is the villain.
Yes.
And it seems to be particularly apposite for sort of today's networked world. I mean, looking at the things that are coming out of the news at the moment. And the way that Quantum was then folded into sort of the Uber network that Spectre is in the most recent.
It's
Not so much a villain there, more of an idea of a villain. But I hope that makes some sense.
It's like a pyramid scheme of villainy.
It is. Yeah. It's like a Ponzi, like what the collective noun, a Ponzi of bad guys.
There you go. That's a quality answer there. So you've got your villains. You liked Goldfinger, and you like the organizational villains, which is something one of my co-hosts, Van Plexico, says, why are we so fascinated with villains that have board meetings? But we are. We love it. But with all the villain talk, what about henchmen? Now, I have a feeling that you're going to be fond of Oddjob because you like...
Well, what is not to like?
Exactly.
About
he's
fantastic, considering, you know, again, a character that doesn't speak at all, I believe, but makes a real lasting impression.
You know, what's funny is a lot of times when you ask people favorite henchmen, you get either Oddjob or Jaws are big ones, and both of them barely speak at all. Yeah. Oddjob speaks none at all, and Jaws only has one line.
Yeah, and I've got to admit, is it Hicks?
Hicks, yeah.
Yeah, I really wanted to see more of him.
Dave Bautista,
however that is pronounced, mm-hmm. you know from Guardians of the Galaxy that, you know, he's got some real comic timing and some real presence.
He really does.
I was kind of disappointed that he was dispatched quite so quickly.
He's a very captivating guy. He's one of those guys that sort of transcended from his professional wrestling career. You know, a lot of wrestlers do some movies and you go, oh, well, there's a wrestler doing a movie. But he's mm-hmm. kind of transcended that. You're right. He has a charm about him and that's it's fun to watch him. It really is.
Yeah. And I guess with the news of that Daniel Craig is doing another Bond, maybe there's a chance that, you know, they can resurrect him. I mean, we don't see him die. We just sort of yanked out of the rail truck, isn't he? So
there you go. We could get another round of Mr. Hanks. That would be super, super cool.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've talked villains and we've talked henchmen. Now let's go to the softer side. Let's speak about the ladies. Do you have a favorite Bond girl? And you can pick one that you like for character, and then if you feel like picking one that you like for more surface level reasons, you can do that as well. But
I did notice you said that, and I'm thinking, who's going to be listening to this?
Exactly.
I have two daughters. What can I possibly say that isn't going to get me into so much trouble?
Oh, I think our audience is probably fairly forgiving. They're all Bond fans, so we know the deal. You know, so I'll publicly state I think that. Daniela Bianchi in From Russia with Love is one of the most gorgeous women I've ever seen.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
So she's tops on my list. And then I have an odd one, which is Talisa Soto from License to Kill. I think she's very gorgeous as well. Goodness. But they're not here to hear about me. They want to know about you. What do you think about your Bond ladies? You got some favorites?
Yeah, well, I mean, predictably, it's going to be half a dozen of them. I mean, again, this I guess is the nerd in me sort of splitting things between classic and modern. But I got to admit, I go for sort of Honor Blackman in Goldfinger.
Oh, she's great.
Diana Rigg in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Excellent.
I mean, I've interestingly both of them. I mean, because I've always loved the Avengers TV show, which I don't know what kind of presence that has in the States, but the Steed and Mrs. Peel era there, and both Honor Blackman and Diana Rigg were really great characters in that.
Right.
And big soft spot for Michelle Yeoh in Tomorrow Never Dies.
Right.
Really liked her because she, you know, they use her as much more of a genuine foil.
Yes.
For Bond, for Pierce in that one, and similar reason, Halle Berry. I mean, but very happy to watch Halle Berry on a screen at pretty much any time of day or night. But again, I enjoyed the fact that, I suppose, in common with Honor Blackman and Diana Rigg's characters, they're more than just kind of a fleshy accompaniment to the Bond, if you see what I mean.
Right, right. No, I noticed the theme when you were naming those. You picked all female characters that had very strong presences, very not very damsel in distress so much as very active participants in the adventure. And that's obviously a very respectable thing.
It's just, not to say that Honor Blackman and Diana Rigg in their prime, absolutely marvelous just to see on the screen.
No doubt. but yeah, they do bring more to the story than a lot of other Bond girls. So that's
I like that too. And just the fact of they kill her at the end, and it's a genuinely oh dear that was a spoiler, wasn't it?
if you're listening to the show and they don't know,
if you haven't seen it already, yes. but they create within her character someone that you genuinely feel sad to lose. And I really like that too.
That's excellent. Moving away from characters and actors and all that bric-a-brac, if you will, we're also big fans of the music and the scores and the soundtracks on this program. Did any of the movies have a particularly lasting soundtrack or score? I have to admit,
no, not really. But a few years back, a friend of mine is a friend of William Orbit, the music producer. So when I heard his adaptation of the Bond themes around that time, I really liked them. I don't think they were ever actually used on a film though.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind of, I mean, there's just the classic never to be beaten John Barry kind of score, really. For me, that's the one that sort of just tells you what to expect and what you're about to experience.
Yeah, John Barry was an amazing storyteller through music and very recognizable. I'll be watching a non Bond film that, and I'll be listening to music and I'll go, this sounds like John Barry. And it always is. He's got a signature. So that's.
Absolutely. And I do remember the, again, it's Casino Royale. I do remember the theme song for that. It took a bit of a beating from the critics, but I actually quite liked it. The one, You Know My Name. I can't remember who that was by, but I actually really liked that. I thought it was of a piece with the film in as much as it was making a statement.
Yes, it was. Chris Cornell did that. And I agree with you. I think it really lent itself to, this is a harder charging, stronger, combat oriented James Bond. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think it fit the tone very well.
Yeah, no, I kind of have a soft spot for that.
Nothing wrong with that. That's excellent. Yeah. Moving out of the realm of the films, now that we've got a barometer for your film loves, and into the...
I can hear you checking your watch going, how long is this going to last?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I'm having a great time here. You mentioned that you had books on the shelf as a kid, and as someone who's written the Bond character for the comics, I imagine you've read a fair amount of the books. Do you have a favorite?
I would come down on Live and Let Die.
Yes.
I would come down on that one. It was the first of the novels that I read. Interestingly, and there's just something that Fleming seems to hit a mix of exoticism and Bond, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. There that I've not seen him. I don't see him sort of achieving in any of the later ones. And I only read Casino Royale actually quite recently.
Same.
And that just struck me as a strange little book. Actually,
it is. Yeah.
That really is like somebody's therapy sessions sort of popped between two covers there.
Well, you
it really surprised me.
Exactly, you and I have that in common. I read it the first time maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I was struck about how similar it was to the movie, like especially the torture scene in the movie. I was like, holy,
yeah,
my goodness, yeah. That's in the book. I was like, that's
very, that surprised me. Yep.
Very edgy for that time, but of course it was Fleming, and Fleming was, you know, he liked to push the air. But yeah, it is a kind of a bizarre journey.
you do start to wonder, is that what is going on? What was going on in English public schools of that period to inspire that kind of a scene?
Oh goodness. Well, I'm just gonna leave that one alone.
Well, actually, I also add that sort of a public school in the UK is a private school. everywhere else.
Yes.
that kind of casual sadism isn't the normal in the state-run sector, I believe.
Excellent. Just dipping our toe into the realm of games. I don't know how much of a gamer you are, whether video games, board games, role-playing games. Bonds sort of popped up in all of them. Have you dabbled in any of that?
No, I haven't. I've never been a huge gamer, although I have been involved in sort of writing scripts for them sort of back through the years, but never been a big gamer myself. My younger brother, I remember he had the GoldenEye game. And so I kind of played that with him and just got roundly thrashed, which sounds like it's going back to the torture scene, I suppose. But no, that's really my only experience of the games. I mean, I've got to admit, I thought it was a really good, involving, smart game.
Yes.
I discovered quite quickly that if I was going to get into computer games, I would just not do anything else. So it became a policy decision to step away from the games, so as I would at least have time to do things like earn a living.
Yes. Far too many people have fallen into the video game and don't earn a living hole of the universe. But I tell you, as far as sort of dipping in the toe and just sampling, well, you sampled a good one. I think GoldenEye is probably widely regarded as probably the best Bond game that they've made. Yeah, it still stands up today, and it was real popular about the time you were writing these comics. So not shortly thereafter, GoldenEye came.
I think it was just a year or two afterwards. Yeah, no, that's right.
And speaking of the comics, let's dive into that. That's your wheelhouse. So let's talk about Silent Armageddon and Shattered Helix. Would you mind telling our listeners what the road was that sort of led you to being a writer of 007 at Dark Horse?
Well, it was, sadly, it all starts in the bar. That was a very common thing. If you talk to anyone involved in the British comic scene, sort of the bar, will loom large. It was at a convention. It was a UK comic art convention back in the early 90s. That was the annual gathering of the clans in those days in London in a hotel. And it just really came out of a conversation with a fellow called Richard Hanson, who was the sort of owner, CEO of a small independent UK publisher called Acme Comics. And he had somehow, I've no idea how, got his hands on the license to produce US format comics from Glidrose. And he mentioned that, and it somehow collided in the conversation with my commenting that a really good villain for Bond or anyone else at this stage would be an artificial intelligence. Bearing in mind, we probably are in sort of 1991, 92. Mm-hmm. Nobody in the general public had much of a clue about things like hacking and cyberspace and computer viruses then.
Right.
And the desktop computer itself was a relatively new machine. And so the two strands of the conversation kind of collided and ended up with Richard saying, well, look, write me an outline. And that's pretty much where it all started. I went away and read up a bit more on the state of computer science at that stage. And also, I discovered that I'd kind of been researching this for a couple of years, because I found a small pile of copies of Scientific American in my office that really covered questions of machine intelligence, efforts to model human learning, model the function of a human brain in kind of both hard and software at that point. You know, these crazy people trying to sort of wire up parallel processing computers, like literally physically doing it. And it kind of went from there. As I was doing my research, I did discover one problem with the whole artificial intelligence issue, is that it's actually a really boring villain. because of its nature, it has none of those human foibles, none of the human greeds and wants and idiosyncrasies that really go into making a great villain. I mean, you know, your Bond villain needs to want to extort the world or set it on fire or something along those lines. And an artificially sort of birthed intelligence, something that's kind of coming out of the digital soup that we were just starting to stir back in the early 90s, wasn't going to really sort of tick that box. And that was where it just kind of you think more about what the humans would want to do with that kind of power, because an artificial intelligence would, as we're seeing in the era of fake news, an artificial intelligence can go in and start manipulating all manner of the systems upon which we've grown to rely. It can be anything from stock markets to missile sort of landing coordinates and air traffic control. Take your pick. And so a villain would love to have that kind of invisible power, kind of becoming, you could become the invisible rulers of the world, much as, you know, a quick glance on Twitter today can hear people saying that's exactly what's happened. My first choice was obviously Spectre, because James Bond comes with his own evil criminal conglomerate,
yes,
ready packed. But because of the time period, this was during the lawsuit between Kevin McClory and Eon and Ian Fleming's estate over Thunderball. I don't know if you've covered that at all in your podcast, but it meant essentially that Spectre was off limits. And so I kind of, it became apparent that if I needed a shadowy criminal conglomerate, I'd have to make my own.
Right.
And that's where a slightly sweaty afternoon worrying about what I was going to do turned into Cerberus or Kerberos. I'm not sure of the pronunciation even now. I think it's Kerberos. My own kind of criminal organization modeled after the three-headed dog from Greek mythology that guards the gates of Hades. And it had three heads, three areas of interest. There were espionage, extortion, and elimination, I think it was. I think it was elimination. And that got folded into the pitch, and amazingly didn't get thrown straight back at me. So yeah, that was how I ended up working for, well, initially for Acme. Acme and Richard had cut a deal with Dark Horse for a kind of a co-production arrangement, which meant also it meant sort of getting access to the direct distribution market in the States.
Right.
And so that was kind of me writing for Dark Horse was kind of me writing for Dark Horse at one remove.
Right.
And had, again, very little problems really with Dark Horse, certainly with, at my end of things. There was a slight delay in Silent Armageddon getting the green light, because I was very much an unknown quantity as a writer at that point. I had, I believe it was two or three professional credits at that point. I'd written a Doctor Who strip and I'd written a young Indiana Jones newspaper strip over here. So I wasn't going to light anybody's interest kind of on fire. But when one of the earlier, it was a pitch by a much better known writer, was kind of knocked back by Fleming's estate, suddenly there was a hole in the publishing schedule, and suddenly that outline that had been sitting on their desk for 6 months looked a lot more interesting. And so off it went to Glidrose, and it came back with nary a change requested. And so light was green, and it was time to write the script.
Excellent. So, you know, good timing and a great opportunity for you. That's a...
It absolutely was. Yeah, at that point, it was for a new writer, it was an absolute gift. It was that classic thing of being paid to learn how to write.
Well, I gotta admit, you did just fine, having read these recently.
That's very kind of you. I look back on them with an enormous amount of affection, and there's a lot that I do still really like in them. But there are just the odd moment where you go, ouch.
As a creator, I know how you feel. Sometimes you look back at your old stuff and you go, oh, I wouldn't have done that, or I would have done this.
Yeah.
How did you end up getting linked up with your art team? I know a writer, you know, you've got your pitch and you know, you do your summary to get people hooked. You write your script. Did you have already art team friends? Did Acme pick them for you? Did Dark Horse pick them for you?
It very much came via Acme. Okay. Because the artist on Silent Armageddon was someone that that Richard really wanted to work with. He's kind of considered something of a legend in the British and European industries. So he was kind of in place sort of very quickly after Dark Horse said go for Silent Armageddon. A Shattered Helix was much more of a dream come true for me, although I had absolutely no influence on the art team coming together, because David Lloyd, who did the covers and the layouts and the inks on Shattered Helix, mm-hmm. Was a longtime hero of mine from the days of V for Vendetta.
Oh, okay.
Because V originally was published in an anthology magazine called Warrior in the mid-80s, and it was totally black and white, and it blew the top off my tiny head. It really did. and absolutely adored it. And I subsequently got to meet him a few times, and he's an absolute gent, complete star. And so to be able to say that I was working on him on James Bond was just wonderful. You know, it was because V, written by Alan Moore, and another of his works, or it was originally called Marvel Man, later called Miracle Man. They were the two things that made me actually think, you know what, writing comics might actually be a sensible career option. So I don't know whether I should thank him or not, really. But the chance to work with David was just a gift. And he very, very kindly gave me the original artwork for the cover of Shattered Helix 1, yep. Which is a real prized possession.
Wow, that is pretty awesome. In fact, they do those little promotional posters that they hang up in comic shops. And while I was preparing my research for you and looking at things, I found one for the promotional poster on eBay, which of course I now own because you keep, whether you know it or not, giving me bills. But yeah, no, that is great art. That is fantastic art. So that,
yeah, I do think David on that cover, he really nails Bond. I think he just really, really, really gets him in terms of the expression and just again. I think I like my Bond to have a certain physicality, and David always brings that to his art. Always.
So very much so. So speaking of the comic creation process, a lot of folks who are fans of the comics and of Bond, there's a lot of talk and chit chat about Silent Armageddon. You know, it's every cover says issue 1 of 4, and 1 and 2 come out, and 3 and 4 never do. And there's been, you know, there's a variety of rumors out on the internet. There's the one that the Fleming estate took issue with how you use the characters. And then there was a rumor about, well, the art just didn't get in on time and the project kind of fizzled. And then, of course, there's the one where you did 10 years for Grand Theft Auto. That last one.
Yeah. I did that too. Yes, that too.
I made up that last one. If you want to take this opportunity to kind of tell the tale, or if it's something that you don't want to discuss, that's fine as well. Really up to you.
No, perfectly happy to speak about it because it was, yes. It's fairly prosaic. It really does just come down to the fact that, unfortunately, for whatever reason, and I never heard whether there was one, a particular reason, the art just got later and later. The first couple came in fine, no problem. The third one was late to the degree that the letterer had to go around to Richard, the editor's apartment, to physically apply the lettering so that it could be FedExed off that night. And after that, didn't hear a word. The artist just went quiet, went dark, carried on working on other things, it turned out, but just didn't get back in touch regarding Bond. And because of the sort of sudden wobble in the schedule, Dark Horse, they kind of suspended publication of Silent Armageddon. And real kind of schedule nerds would notice that Shattered Helix 1 and 2 came out between what would have been Silent Armageddon 2 and Silent Armageddon 3. I'd already been they'd already gone into production, kind of thing, but it was brought forward in order to fill the gap that had been kind of caused actually by Silent Armageddon 3's very, very tight turnaround. Unfortunate and boring and mundane. Yeah, I'm afraid so. And I mean, after that, it kind of put Dark Horse off. And you'll notice that sort of the whole Bond line kind of came to an end quite soon afterwards. And as far as I'm aware, it wasn't so much down to poor sales or poor reader reaction. It was down to being unable to fulfill orders to distributors and to comic shops and to retailers. At the time that the cancellation was made, I had a short piece that had just been given the go ahead by Ian Fleming's people, which would involve Bond meeting up with a 00 who'd gone rogue. And he'd gone rogue because for the first time he'd actually stopped in the middle of a mission and looked around at the amount of misery that this kind of realpolitik causes to sort of ordinary people. Mm-hmm. And that was going to go ahead. That was going to be drawn by a British artist called Pete Doherty. And I was working up a pitch for a larger six-part Bond at that time as well. I figured Cerberus should go whole hog. They want the ultimate in diplomatic immunity, and they do that by just taking over a country.
Nice.
And Bond would be sort of in the thick of that. But sadly, I mean, as every writer and artist has, a small filing cabinet probably of projects that almost made it, got canned for one reason or the other. Sadly, this one, it was kind of impressive in the wrong way that one artist's unreliability could actually kill an entire line.
Oh, I hate that happened.
Yeah, but that's just the way it went, unfortunately. So yeah, hopefully that's mystery solved.
Yeah, sounds like it. Only one other mystery is did issue 3 of Silent Armageddon ever see a light of day? Because I've never seen a copy of issue 3.
No, it never did.
Okay, but it was created.
Oh, it was absolutely created. All 4 scripts were written, and issue 3 was completely drawn, painted, and lettered and sent off. This is in the days before digital delivery of artwork. Mm-hmm. So literally the balloons were hand lettered and hand applied to the artwork, and it was all sent off, I believe, via FedEx. And that was the last that was seen of it. I've no idea what happened to the artwork.
Oh man. Somebody somewhere has got the missing issue of Silent Armageddon 3, which is interesting too, because I don't know if you know much about the GoldenEye comic that came out, but that also had a third issue that was never released.
No, I did.
Yeah, I think Topps had the license for the GoldenEye comic.
Yeah.
And I think they did a 3 issue, and I think 3 never came out. Two might have not come out either, but yeah, so similarly mysterious backstory about how they...
You're starting to sound like a jinx somewhere on Bond comics.
Maybe so. But at least we got some good stuff out of you. I really, just as a reader, just a little, you know, here's feedback for you 20-some years down the line. I thought the Cerberus thing, I say Cerberus, I don't know how it's pronounced, was a clever idea, because I did know that, you know, Spectre was off limits. I've seen other creators, you know, I think Raymond Benson made the Union, and... He had a group called the Union, and I'd seen in video games they had a organization called Octopus. You know, Spectre had the Octopus symbol. Uh-huh. But I think Cerberus is very clever. I like the way that had a designed logo. All villains need a great logo. Was that logo off your design, or did the artist come up with the Cerberus three-headed dog fiery logo?
It's always a bad idea to ask me to draw anything. but what I did do is I do remember describing it in the panel descriptions. The first time Bond is presented with the Cerberus pin, I described it in some detail. I mean, I tend to in comics, I've always worked what they call full script, so everything is broken down and everything is described as well as possible, just so as the artist then has all the information in my head, so that they can then add their own, and that's where you hopefully, you know, the magic happens.
Excellent. So overall, writing these things, what's the best thing about writing Bond? And then we'll flip that on its ear and say, what's the most challenging thing about writing Bond?
Right. If you asked me at the time what the best thing about writing Bond was, it was getting paid to write.
Paychecks are important. Nice.
I think, as I've mentioned, I was a very new writer. I only had a couple of credits. And actually, the thing that concerned me the most was write well enough so that you don't get fired. And that was the best thing. The best thing was actually having 22 pages to each issue to just really go to town on. And that's why I think if you were to ask me, one of the weaknesses of Silent Armageddon is it's sort of formally all over the place. I'm trying out half a dozen different sort of effects and techniques in each issue, but that was because someone was offering me money and letting me go away and do it, and that was just great fun. I did include one little thing for the sort of the Bond geek in me, and I bringing back the name of Kleb into Bond was a lot of fun. And another one of those little things where if I'd thought too much about it, I'd have gone, no one's ever going to let me do this.
Yes.
But I did it and nobody complained. So so I was very happy. I mean, he's got a whole backstory of how he came to be, especially when you consider that Rosa Klebb's famously sapphically inclined.
Yes.
But yeah, it was being able to thrash about in that kind of swimming pool, really, with the abandon of someone who really doesn't have much of a clue what he's doing.
The bringing back of Rosa Klebb's, I'm assuming it's maybe the son.
He's an illegitimate son.
It's like it's a great cliffhanger in issue two, and then we never get to see
it. Never get to see it.
Where it goes. Oh, man. And I think that was a great idea because, like you said before, it's tough to fight a digital bad guy. And what was really drawing me in on Silent Armageddon, and don't get me wrong, it was good, solid all the way through, but what was really drawing me in was I was like, oh, my goodness, this henchman, and it was revealed to be what I assumed was the son of Rosa Klebb, and I was like, oh, now it's really getting exciting. And then, of course, that's where we leave off, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, he goes on to play a sort of a larger role in the next two next two issues. And again, I was, you know, with all of the arrogance that comes with it, complete ignorance, I was laying plans that if I was allowed to write more, Cerberus would continue sort of throughout them. And what you'd actually see is Klebb's gradual rise to become one of the heads of Cerberus. That was kind of always my plan for him.
Oh, cool. What a great idea.
Sadly, I never got the he does assassinate his boss in the script for the last issue, just to let you know.
Oh, now we know. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Some closure.
Yep. He finally gets sick of being pushed around, so he just shoots him in the head.
Oh, goodness. Now, in the questions I sent you to do this interview, the question I wrote down is said, which, if any, of the 007 novel writers influenced you in writing the comics? Mm-hmm. Let's expand that. It doesn't have to be novel writers. It doesn't have to be 007. You've talked about how you're into comics. So what writers in general, whether they be 007, comic writers, whatever, what writers really kind of stuck with you and inspired you?
Well, in comics, it's Alan Moore. So someone of a British writer, kind of my vintage. We read Alan Moore's work in Warrior, and we read him in Swamp Thing. And as I say, that was the first time I took seriously the idea of writing comics for a living. I kind of had always had vague ambitions to write fiction, but it was Alan's work that really sort of drew me into the comics.
I've heard of him. I think he's a scrappy young writer who's.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm guessing you probably have heard of him. I'm not sure.
He's kind of a big.
Yeah. If you go to a British comics convention and sort of throw something into the scrum, and you'll hit someone who's been influenced by Alan.
He's a talented man.
Yeah, he did. He made an enormous impact. And so that's really that was the name that was really looming over me as I was writing. And again, thinking about especially Silent Armageddon, you can see it. If you know that I'm a big fan of Alan Moore, you can see me sort of trying out some of his stuff and definitely being influenced by the way he would put a page together and the way he would use text over image to juxtapose rather than to just follow. So the text would be doing one thing, the visual would be doing another, and both of them would be like feeding their information into the reader, and that's kind of where the comic happens at that point. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, definitely him. Ian Fleming, less of an influence, I think, as much because by that point it had been some time since I'd read any of the novels, and my immediate research for writing the comics had been the films. And I don't know if you find it as well. I always think that James Bond's a bit like Sherlock Holmes as a character. He's kind of escaped where he came from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and he's kind of out there running around throughout the culture. And so I was kind of more influenced perhaps by this kind of general cultural melange kind of character. So yeah, it's quite hard to fix on any other influences beyond Alan, because just Alan was the major comic book influence on me at the time. And I was just really focused on writing the best comic I could, because I didn't want to get fired after the first issue kind of thing. So yeah, it's definitely down to him, I'm afraid.
No, nothing wrong with that. That's a
tall hairy guy in the corner. It's his fault.
It's his fault.
Yeah.
When you wrote your comics, you're sitting there at your, keyboard or typewriter. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you went old school back in the day, but did you have a Bond pictured in your mind? Were you thinking, as you're writing, you sort of see Connery doing your thing or Roger doing your thing, or any particular Bond in mind when you're writing?
I didn't have consciously in mind, again, because of the way that he does seem to have sort of broken loose from any particular, although I do remember having a conversation with Richard, the editor, and he was the first one who mentioned to me that when asked, Fleming had pointed to Hoagy Carmichael, the jazz singer,
right,
from the, I believe, the 20s or 30s, as kind of the physical model for Bond. And he's got sort of quite a rugged kind of face, certainly not a sort of a film star kind of face, certainly not to my eyes. So I kind of kept. He was in mind, and also Timothy Dalton, again, because I liked Timothy Dalton because he was, again, a left field choice, I think, as much, certainly physically and how he looks on screen. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that. And I guess subconsciously I was trying to go for a slightly left field approach to Bond myself. I mean, just look at my first Bond girl. She's 13 years old and paraplegic. It's not an immediate first choice, really. And if I'd have known any better, I probably wouldn't have done it.
Well, that's it is a creative choice, especially when you look at Silent Armageddon cover number one. You're right. You've got Bond action pose. You've got the young paraplegic Asian girl with him. He's got that protective arm around her. And it's something that, you got to give you points for creativity. We've never really seen the whole, Bond protects a child aspect. And there's been a couple of movies since you wrote your comic that have really hit on that, like Mercury Rising. And there was one with Jason Statham where he was protecting a girl like that in the name title.
Oh, it's not called The Driver, The Transporter, the first of the Transporter films.
Transporter films. He did another film called Safe where he protected a little girl. It's like come along, but like I feel like you kind of started it almost.
I will take that credit. I absolutely will.
But yeah, I know.
Creating Terry, it really is. Terry Lee is just something that, I can only give credit to my complete ignorance and arrogance there, on the arrogance that comes from it.
You played her against all kinds of type too, because in the story, she doesn't respond to 007 like most, women and girls do. Like, oh, look at this complete dreamboat. She wants nothing to do with him.
No. I mean, it was always my intention to sort of throw him into this kind of parental role that he's not really suited to and that she's not interested in, because she's smarter than, she is the smartest person in any room that she goes into. Mm-hmm. So she has no time for him.
That was brilliant.
And part of what you hopefully see through the story is they do, they gradually form a very close and emotional bond with each other. But unfortunately, you didn't get to see that. Well, he becomes more comfortable with the paternal role, and she comes out of her shell because she's had a tough life before before being discovered as a prodigy, she was living in the hidden city, which was a pretty rough environment before it was bulldozed and built over as it is now.
Excellent choices. Excellent choices. Now, here's a fun question for you. Let's say you have a great day, right? You're at your keyboard. Your phone rings. You pick it up, and it's Michael G. Wilson, and he's like, "Hey, we want to take one of your comic stories and make it the next Bond film." First of all, you'll probably jump up, dance, start counting your money in advance, things like that. if you could pick, and Michael says to you, "Hey, you can pick any actor to be your Bond." Who can you pick? And by the way, just for the funsies of this question, you can have a time machine. So if you want to go take Connery in his prime, you could do that. You could take any actor, any time to play your Bond if they made Silent Armageddon or Better Neelix in the movies. Who'd be your God, man?
Well, I saw that question. That is a really tough question. The thing with Sean Connery is he's done his Bond. He's made his Bond, and no one can touch what he's done, kind of thing. So, I wouldn't attempt to force my stuff onto him. I was thinking. I mean, I always like to look at what's going on, who's going on around, and the people I found myself thinking about was Dominic West. I don't know if you know him at all. Dominic West, English actor. He was in 300. He's playing Lara Croft's father, of all things, in the new Tomb Raider. He's a slightly older choice now, I must admit. But again, he's got like a real sense of physicality about him. He could handle any of that. He's also fantastic actor. Dominic Cooper, another Dominic, younger. He's currently in Preacher. I think he could be a very different Bond to Dominic West. Dominic West would be sort of the crunchier, more physical, whereas Dominic Cooper more of the, I don't know, snake-hipped Bond. Yeah, probably one of those two. I think I would go. They would be the first people I'd see if I could I could entice. I think.
What's funny is I know Dominic West from his appearance in the Johnny English film.
Oh, really? Johnny, oh, right. The affair has been a big hit for him as well. He's done it, so we need someone else.
Leave it to the American guy to be like, oh, I know him from Johnny English. He's probably done a million wonderful things, right? Although I do love Johnny English. Me and my son watch him and just laugh and laugh.
Oh, really? Oh, good. No, I haven't seen him in that. Is that in the first? Because I think John Malkovich is the villain in the first one.
Yeah, it was in the second one. Johnny English.
Oh, I haven't seen that. Oh, right.
It's very good. But we're Rowan Atkinson fans here in my household. We champion the Bean.
The Bean. Have you also sampled the Blackadder?
Oh, there you go. We just recently got the Blackadders, and we're going to start watching those.
Oh, fantastic. You are in for a treat.
but back to your world. Did you, in your writing process, when you sit down and write, do you like to have music? Like if you're writing Bond, do you like to have Bond music? Do you like complete silence? Do you like some other kind of music? What's your writing process like when you sit down to write these comics that you did?
For any first draft, it has to be silence, I'm afraid. Yeah, silence and the power of swearing seem to be the two common strands through my entire career. But yes, definitely. When I'm certainly a first draft of anything from back in my comics days to now, I like to write at a desk. I like to have a keyboard. I'm the kind of person scribbles on a legal pad, works stuff out there, and then puts it straight through the keyboard onto the computer. Silence, especially in the morning if I'm drafting. Sometimes I do find myself, if I need a little kick in the afternoon, I'll put on just something loud. Is a big thing for me. Usually classical, again, because the one thing is it's you're spending the day trying to get the right words out of your head, and the last thing you need is somebody else's words kind of in your ear, on your shoulder, especially if they're better than the ones you're coming up with on that particular day. So yeah, really a very, very standard kind of process of notes and keyboard, swearing, notes, keyboard, coffee. And that was, I did used to drink a lot more coffee in those days. So yeah, that was, it is that classic. I like to be in the place I know. I'm not someone who can write when there are a lot of other people around me. I mean, I know people whose backgrounds may be in journalism and things, and they're really used to working in an office environment with lots of ambient noise. And that's not something that I've ever been able to do. I'm alone in a room. It's just the saddest. It's the saddest image. I'm alone in a room, the door's shut, nobody wants to know me, I don't want to know anybody else. And that's where the pages come from.
There's nothing wrong with that. I'm no Simon Jowett. I've written exactly one comic book in my life, but I was the same way. If someone tries to talk to me, I'm almost grumpy. I'm like, I'm trying to get this thought out of my head, you know, and don't talk to me right now, you know. I'm no fun either.
No, I know. I have to get my girls used to the fact that, dad's in his room. Leave him alone.
Leave him alone. There you go. Oh, goodness. Do you still have, and I think you kind of alluded to this earlier, so I think you do, but do you still have a sort of a burning 007 story idea kind of down in your basement, if you will, you'd love to bring forward again someday?
No, you're absolutely right. I mentioned it when I was sort of relating the sad tale of the Dark Horse James Bond line.
Yes.
Yeah, I was already working on a couple of stories. As I say, there was a short piece that was going to go in. It was going to be serialized over four of Dark Horse's anthology book, Dark Horse Presents.
Right.
And that was the one about meeting the 007 who'd become disenchanted with what he was being required to do. And that pitch had been greenlit by the Fleming Estate. I'd been taking some reference shots because at the time I knew some people who were involved in polo and had a big polo scene in it. And so I was sort of taking reference shots of polo and various horsey things. And then I was going to write that one. And at the same time as I was writing that, I was going to pitch my idea, my big six part idea where Cerberus decided to take over a country. And yeah, they're the two. After that, everything sort of went a little bit pear shaped. And so they never saw the light of day, unfortunately. But it's surprising. When somebody asks, you go, God, yeah. Even now, after 20 years, you're like,
yeah. Yes. You still feel the call.
Yes. Yeah, it is the weirdest thing. So, if anybody from E.ON is listening, I'm here.
Excellent. Have you been reading the more recent stuff that Dynamite's been putting out? It's been very good.
I picked up Warren Ellis's first set, Varga.
Right.
Varga, I believe it was. But I tend to get into the shops so rarely. I picked Varga up it was out as a trade.
Yes.
And I get into comic shops so rarely now that I haven't been back for any more. I know he did at least one more, didn't he?
He did.
And there have been some since.
Another run called Eidolon, and then some other writers have come on and done arcs, all available on trade, by the way, so I highly recommend them.
Oh, that'd be great.
But what you're also saying is that if anyone from Dynamite is listening, since they're making the comics, they should totally reach out to you.
Absolutely. There have been times down through the years where the possibility of writing some more comics has come up. And whatever it is about that medium, it's still got its hooks in me. And so, yeah, no, I'm very happy to sort of write more comics. It's just finding the avenues, really, because I kind of stepped out of comics in the late 90s when there was a big crash that there'd been like a speculator-fueled bubble. It was the time of the die-cut, multiple variant covers.
It's got to have foil on it and glow in the dark.
That's right, and holes in it and shapes and what, you name it. And I'd been writing for Marvel's UK arm at that time, and then the market collapsed. Pretty much everything collapsed. And I found myself without a comic to write. But fortunately, certainly for the British creatives, there was a pub to find myself in. And that's, I kind of found myself in a pub with a bunch of animators. And they said, oh, you write comics. Oh, we love comics. Have you ever considered writing animation? And that's kind of where sort of the second chapter in the career started.
Yeah, I believe when I was stalking you on the internet, I believe I cracked a smile because I was like, well, he's got his hooks in me with 007 and he's got his hooks in my kids because haven't you done some Bob the Builder?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that was kind of where I ended up after sort of the meeting with the animators. I wrote for Bob from his second season through to about his eighth or ninth.
Goodness, this is back when they were,
this is Bob the Builder when it was still stop motion animation.
Right.
Like still model animation rather than now, I believe it's CG. And yeah, that was my first steps into animated TV. And I've written for the US networks, European networks. I've written on a lot of shows here up and down the age range from preschool. And it's quite apt that you're phoning me today because yesterday an animated TV show, a preschool show that I co-created, premiered on a UK network.
Oh, congratulations.
It's called Shane the Chef, and the clue is in the title.
Okay.
But that's something that myself and ironically a former comics artist put together. His name's Andrew, and he drew my very first professional job, and he went on to become very well known in Transformers fan circles. Because he drew an absolute ton of Transformers comics.
Oh, that's amazing.
And he now has another string to his bow. He designs characters and he storyboards. He's done storyboarding on Doctor Who and various shows in the UK. And this is something we've put together and have sort of shopped around for years and finally found a home for. And premiered yesterday, and it's going to be coming out now just for the next 18 months or so, I think, new episodes.
Well, good for you. Congratulations. So, and it's always good to hear that folks that you know from one thing, like I know you from comics, and then you kind of disappear from comics. And it's good to know that you're successful and fulfilled in other things, you know. It's good to know you're not living in the pub somewhere underneath of a table.
Oh, well, I'm still living in the pub.
Oh, you still do? Okay. But you've got your own money to spend. You're not having to borrow, right? I got
that's the big difference.
That's the difference. Well, speaking of all this non-007 work you talked about, the next question that I had for you was, you know, what non-007 work have you done that you're most proud of? And it certainly sounds like you've got your co-created series coming off the ground. So that's got to be high up there. But
well, right now it is Shane the Chef. It's one of those curious things where the overnight success has taken a very long time, kind of thing. and we've been working on it for years. And animation has a huge lead time, so I have scripts dating back an alarming distance that are now finally going to be broadcast. Yeah. It's a combination of pride and just relief more than anything else. That it's finally out and about, and you can talk about it, and that's really lovely. And also that thing just leads on to sort of, right, what comes next? There's a kind of a nice feeling of that about things at the moment as well.
That's super exciting. I'm glad that you've got your property out there. I know what you're talking about, though. It takes a long lead time. It's so fulfilling.
It is nice. I mean, compared to writing a comic, it can be a matter of like 3 months from writing the script to seeing the comic on a shelf. In TV, it is very different, and in animation, it's even more so because just the extra amount of time that goes into the animation process. So it's lovely to finally see it out there.
That is definitely awesome. So Shane the Chef, everybody go out and support Shane the Chef. Everyone who's listening,
please do. It's on Channel 5 in the UK, which is owned by Viacom, who I believe also own Nick and Nick Jr. So fingers crossed, that's probably where Shane will appear in the US.
All right, everybody get out your Twitter tweets and start tweeting at Nick Jr. and start asking for Shane the Chef.
Yeah.
Shane the Chef.
Yep, Shane the Chef. He's got an annoyingly catchy theme tune, which has been playing in my head for far too long. And it's aimed at preschoolers, and it's meant to encourage a little bit of healthy eating, give the kids an idea of where the food actually comes from, fresh food, because there are alarming surveys, certainly in this country, of children who don't know where a carrot comes from and wouldn't know an onion if it shook their hand, kind of thing. So it's just a little bit of a little secret agenda to just get kids back into the idea of fresh food and cooking it and helping out when the cooking's being done.
Well, it's definitely going to help when the zombie apocalypse happens. You gotta start growing your own food.
These kids, well, you have to, yeah, absolutely.
Have to know this. Well, that's really great. And as you can see from the questions I provided you, the last question was, are you currently working on any other projects that you'd like to plug? Do you got anything coming up after Shane the Chef that you'd like our audience to know about?
Not that I can mention at the moment. I mean, we are still, I mean, despite the fact that Shane is now being broadcast, we are still writing the last few scripts of the series. Mm-hmm. They're still being written. So I'm kind of really tidying up there because I'm a head writer on the whole thing and working with a team of like really awesome writers on the last few scripts. So we're getting that tidied away and anything else will sort of necessity come after that.
Well, that about brings us to the end. I want to remind our listeners to, if you haven't already, go out and find you some copies of Silent Armageddon 1 and 2. Don't go for 3 and 4 because they're not there. If you do happen to have a copy of 3, let me know. I'd probably buy it off of you.
I'd be very interested as well, actually, yeah.
And, of course, Shattered Helix. Shattered Helix is a two-issue series from Dark Horse as well. Easy to pick up.
That one you do at least get the whole story.
Yeah. Yes, you do. And by all means, let's get Shane the Chef cracking over here in the United States.
Please do. Any strings you can pull.
Anything we can pull. And everybody, let's start bothering Dynamite Comics to see if they can get Simon to write some more 007 for us. That'd be amazing.
That would be such fun. Really would. It's definitely one of those things where this is not false enthusiasm. That would be such fun.
Simon, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be here.
Been a pleasure, Jared. It really has.
Well, we appreciate it so much, and hopefully we can maybe have you back again sometime. That'd be great. If you've got some time, if you want to be on any episodes, you let us know, okay?
I'd love to. You know where I live.
I do. I've got you now. I've got my digital hooks into you. So thanks again for being here, and this has been a very special episode of Honor Majesty's Secret Podcast. We've featured Simon Jowett. Check out his comics, check out his cartoons, and Honor Majesty's Secret Podcast will return. In addition to once again thanking Mr. Simon Jowett for being here today, I would like to thank Pat DJ Cristado Sampson for editing this episode. It's very fortunate that Pat did, because this episode was very much about comic books, and you can check out Pat Sampson's show, The Long Box Crusade, available on almost all your podcatchers. I highly recommend it. They're an entertaining group talking about entertaining comics. So thanks, Pat, for the edit, and thanks again to Mr. Simon Jowett for being on the program. We'll catch you later on Her Majesty's Secret Podcast.